Nate Cannon is the author of Running on a Mind Rewired, a memoir in which he shares willingly his battles with gender identity, drug addiction, and a neurological disorder, dystonia. The book was published in November 2011 and has since been praised by Billy McLaughlin, a world-renowned guitarist and composer who battles musicians' dystonia, as an honest story about what it means to be different in a world that prefers perfection. Nate is using Running on a Mind Rewired to inspire people to be honest with themselves and speak out about the uncomfortable topic of transgender issues in today's society. In this multi-part interview, Cannon, formerly Jennifer, talks about the struggles of self-identity and how he overcame the internal emotions and public scrutiny to become the man he is today. The first part takes you into Nate's past, beginning as a young girl growing up in Iowa in the 1980s and interested in hockey, with the only opportunity to play on a boys' team. Join me, Karina Borash, as we move through the issues of physical pain, drug addiction, rehab treatment, and gender struggles, as Nate opens up about his history and what has kept him alive all these years. For KVSC News, I'm Karina Borash, here with Nate Cannon, who wrote a book, Running on a Mind Rewired, which shares very personal details from your life. Nate has accepted my invitation to talk about his book as well as address transgender issues circulating in the media today. So first of all, thank you, Nate, for being here. And now I want to start off by talking about the content of your book and what you wrote about. At the beginning, you talk about hockey and how it was a big role in your life. Can you tell me about when you got involved with hockey?
Hockey was something that growing up in Iowa in the 80s, we just didn't have girls' hockey. So being a girl who had those transgender tendencies and wanted to kind of stay in the boys' world, of course I played girls' soccer and girls' basketball and things like that, but when I saw the hockey brochures being handed out one winter and a lot of my friends were playing, I looked at it and it said boys and girls welcome, and I said, aha, there's my ticket. That's the way I can stay with one foot in the boys' world. So that became a really integral part of my life.
And how old were you when you started playing?
I believe I was eight.
Eight? Oh, wow. So tell me a little bit about getting involved and what struggles you went through as a girl playing on a boys' team.
Well, everything was pretty smooth up until you get to be about 12, when a couple things change, of course, with your body is starting to change, hormones are starting to change, but also in the rules of hockey, the rules are starting to change, and in boys' hockey, checking becomes allowed, so once that happened and the boys started to hit their growth spurts and I didn't, it started to look more like I had a target on my back with the long flowing brown ponytail that I had. So I started to take some cheap shots and suffered a couple concussions. At that point in time, though, we really didn't know what dangerous concussions posed for athletes, and it was kind of like, if I'm still able to stand up and skate, then I'm going to make my way back to the bench, and I certainly couldn't let those boys see me stay down as the only girl on the ice.
You don't want to seem weak.
Right. I had to prove myself. So I got up from some pretty tough hits, and it was tough too in terms of backlash from some of my teammates who were kind of uncomfortable with the girl being on their team when we got to be 14, 15. Other teammates were very protective of me, so it was an interesting mix on my own team, but when I did have a very serious shoulder injury, I got hit from behind and thrown headfirst into the boards during a game, knocked me out and dislocated my shoulder, and I understood that my teammates really came to my defense during that game after I left. So that was a big change right there that put me out of hockey.
Going back to that moment, what went through your mind after you got hit? And I remember in your book you described laying on the ice thinking, I'm hurt.
Yeah, when I came to consciousness, I couldn't feel anything. I couldn't move anything. And I remember just staring through my face mask at the ice, and I just screamed. That was my first response. I'd never not been able to get myself up after a hit, and I physically could not move. I was afraid I was paralyzed. Slowly, the feeling started to come back to my feet and my legs, tingling sensations and so forth, and by the time the trainer got out there, I was able to move my legs, but it was my arm that I couldn't move, and it turned out that my shoulder was dislocated.
And so you went to the hospital, and what did you find out there?
An orthopedic surgeon put it back into its socket, which isn't a very pleasant process, but it was an interesting experience because it was the first time that I was given a mood-altering drug of the level that I was, and they gave me a medication called Versed to just kind of calm me down so that I wouldn't feel the pain of having the shoulder put back in its socket. And I think that was the first time that I realized that I could take a chemical that would translate into a change in how I felt. I was in the worst pain of my life, and yet I sat there giggling and laughing at absolutely nothing, primarily just because of the effect of the drug. And so after that hit, I was left with some chronic pain, and that's when I started to seek out chemicals to kind of self-medicate.
And what chemicals did you find?
I really fell in hard with cocaine. Primarily started with snorting it, and ended up not soon after I started. It was within about, I'd say about 3 weeks that I started stealing from my mom and maxing out her credit cards and so forth. And that when that came to her attention, she got me into treatment real quick.
Do you remember the first time that you used cocaine?
Yes, I do. It was one of those moments where your brain kind of goes, wow, this is what I've been missing, and this is what I need to function. And there is a lot of evidence now to show that there might be a self-medication hypothesis behind cocaine use, that it might actually be a drug of choice for people who, in my case, I was later diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and that might have been a way to actually self-medicate in a way that A, numb my physical pain, B, numb my emotional pain, but it also helped me to throw my efforts back into school. I'd been a very good student, and with the loss of hockey, I just really went full bore into my academics.
And so after this injury, you were not able to play hockey ever again, or for how long?
I think the orthopedic surgeon wanted me out for about 3 months. I think I ended up back on the ice within about 6 weeks. I just couldn't stay away. And unfortunately, that's when the shoulder kept popping out and I kept having recurrent dislocations and partial dislocations that really set me back. But I just wasn't in a place where I was ready to stop playing, until my addiction became so strong that just was no longer an option. And by that point, I became apathetic enough that I wasn't willing to go forward with surgery on my shoulder. It was a really great loss, and that happened during my sophomore year of high school, which if hockey players out there know, that's a critical year for being recruited for college hockey. And there was some schools up here, including St. Cloud State, that I was interested in potentially going to school to play at. And so knowing that things kind of got set back in that area, that was a big blow to my self-esteem, absolutely. I did manage to go on and play at Gustavus, played 2 years there, varsity, and had switched into the goalie role after my freshman year there. Had a little bit of experience trying out playing a little bit of goaltender when I was in high school. It was kind of encouraged by the parents that maybe you shouldn't be out there taking these hard hits anymore. And I tried goalie for a little while, and I had a knee injury, and I said, well, forget that, I want to play up front anyway. But by the time I got to college and I realized that my shoulder was impairing me as much as it was, the goalie role actually felt very comfortable for me, and things just kind of fell into place from there. So I did find my spot on the team and was able to fulfill that lifelong dream of playing college hockey.
But before all this happened, you did go through some struggles with your drug addiction.
Absolutely.
You mentioned stealing from your mom. What happened when she found out?
Well, I recall sitting at my kitchen table, and she had made a phone call to the credit card company to tell them that there had been some charges on there that she was concerned about. And they proceeded to tell her the degree to what those charges had been made and how much money had been taken out. And I remember her saying that I want whoever did this to be put behind bars. And that was, I could just feel my stomach just drop. It just felt like something that I needed to come forward. I'd had a great relationship with my mom, and I still do to this day. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to come clean with her, because I couldn't let that the financial implications of what I was doing continue to mount on her, and I felt that it was time for me to just come clean.
So what did you say to her?
I wrote a letter, actually, and I just kind of wrote out what had happened and how I kind of got involved in the wrong circles and got mixed up in these drugs, and that it was me, and I took responsibility for my actions and told her I needed help.
And in a situation like that, how did your mother react, knowing that you were coming forward and you were admitting to her what you had done? Because you do value your relationship with your mom.
She was very grateful, to mm-hmm. be honest. I think I'm very fortunate in that my mom was a social worker, so she was very educated in matters of mental health and addiction and that kind of thing. So she really took a very empathic approach to it, and not punitive in the sense that we're going to help you get some help so that you can get better, and I'm not going to punish you for the things that you did because of your addiction.
When did you realize that you were addicted? That you were using these substances to the point where you'd consider yourself a drug addict?
pretty early on with cocaine. That was a pretty rapid addiction. My first treatment after I admitted to my mom about the stealing didn't go so well. Did get kicked out of that treatment for some questionable reasons.
And that was rehab treatment?
Yeah, my first rehab treatment there. And I think I knew before going in there that I had a problem. It became clear to me, I think, when I would tell myself, okay, I've had 3 lines tonight, I'm going to put the rest in the closet and I'm not going to touch it until tomorrow, and then I'd try and sleep and there was no way I was going to be able to sleep, so then I'd get up and I'd go back to the closet and I'd end up chopping another line, and then I'd find by the end of the night that I'd been up all night and I'd used everything that I had. I think that was when I knew that this was beyond my control.
Now, how many times did you go to rehab treatment?
I believe it was a total of 8.
Tell me a little bit about what you learned or what you went through.
Mm-hmm. The first treatment I had, my mom was trying to get me in wherever I could get in as quick as possible. And that experience was interesting because I was 17 at the time, but they felt it was more appropriate for an adult program. So I went through the adult program, but I was still not taking it very seriously. I kind of thought that this was something that, okay, I go through rehab and then things will be fine afterwards. So I didn't really take the program seriously while I was in there. But unfortunately, I did have an instance where I was asked to participate in some piano lessons. I'd taken piano when I was a kid, and I thought, well, this would be a great way for me to get back into doing something with my fingers other than playing with drugs. And it ended up that the counselor who was working with me on those piano lessons ended up touching me inappropriately. And when I reported that, they took his side and kicked me out of treatment. So that, I think, set me up for a lot of further troubles in trusting the very people who I was expected to trust in order to get better. So that I think was a big setback. The second treatment I went through, I just wasn't in it. My heart wasn't in it. I ended up relapsing using meth. I had someone bring it in from the outside, and I got kicked out of that treatment as well. And it wasn't until after I had gotten to Gustavus and was asked to leave the hockey team, was failing out of my freshman semester, which, had I gotten that semester of Fs, would have just set me up for complete failure throughout my college career. So I was very, very grateful that my mom came together with the administration at Gustavus, and Gustavus realized that something's going on here that's medical. They were able to get me out, get me into the hospital, get me into treatment, and instead of a semester of Fs, I got a semester of Ws. And that was actually the first time I was able to graduate from a rehab program. And from there on, I really was able to kind of kick that cocaine, which became a crack problem, for good, but made the leap into alcoholism, if you will. I had a substitution addiction that kind of came in at that point, which, as we know, alcohol is pretty prevalent in the college campus, so that became difficult for me to avoid.
Alcohol, too, it's more society acceptable. It's legal when you're 21, and I see where you're coming from, thinking that it's a better substitution.
Absolutely, and I think, too, it was helpful for me to go into an environment like Gustavus to get away from where I was at in Iowa. There's a lot of evidence to support the geographic relocation is very helpful for cocaine in particular in terms of recovery, that you just, to use AA phrasing, you need to get away from your playgrounds and playmates and find new playgrounds and playmates. And that's what I was able to do by going into Gustavus. And when I was there, it was very different in that there's no crack at Gustavus, which is a fantastic thing, but there's also a lot of stigma about crack. And since I'd made that transition from the powder cocaine, which had that kind of, oh, it's cool, glamorous kind of reputation for a while, and then became a crack addict, then that wasn't very glamorous. There's nothing glamorous about crack addiction. And so I could kind of feel that pushback on campus, and then, oh, that's that drug addict. And so I kind of had developed that reputation, unfortunately. And I felt that was actually something that kind of helped me kick it for good. But unfortunately, I wasn't ready to quite address the alcohol issue.
That's an overcoming story, too. That's how you overcame your crack addiction.
Mm-hmm.
Did you go into treatment after that?
Yes, alcohol treatment. I went in, let's see, that was the first time there at Gustavus was primarily for alcohol, and that was the first one I graduated from. And then after that, I was somewhat of a functional alcoholic for a while, for about 3 years, until I managed to, it just kind of took over. It really impacted me to the degree that I wasn't functioning very well in hockey, I wasn't functioning very well in my classes, and it was very much impacting my relationship with my girlfriend. I had come out as a lesbian, and we had a pretty strong relationship, but we both had an appetite for alcohol, if you will. And at some point, my addiction just became too strong. We got into an altercation, and I did end up hitting her, which to this day is something that I feel great remorse for and something I would not do without the influence of chemicals in my system. But that did happen, and that ended up resulting in my being kicked out, for lack of a better term, from Gustavus. I returned back home to Sioux City, where I ended up getting arrested and charged with a DUI. So I did end up going through treatment again after that, just to basically just satisfy the state and the county to get that done, and made that geographic change again to come back up to Minneapolis, where I enrolled at the University of Minnesota. I was a functional alcoholic there for about 2 years, didn't actually have to go to treatment, managed to do okay in my classes, but I structured them very interestingly. I would structure them not too early, not too late, so that I could manage to go between about a 10 and 2:30 class period so I could sleep in and then just get my drinking going in the afternoon. And at some point after I had cheated on my girlfriend with my ex, she gave me an ultimatum and said, "You either get sober or this is over." And I knew by that point that it was starting to take a toll on my health. I was starting to make myself vomit. My diet just really consisted of basically alcohol and nothing else. I think at some point in that, I realized that I needed to do this for me. And it didn't matter how many people were telling me, "You gotta get help, you have a problem, this is gonna kill you." That if I didn't start to realize it for myself and realize that I need to get help for myself, I wasn't going to be able to turn that corner. And so I think it was all of those things kind of put together that made me go, "Okay, I'm ready." And it was only when I said that and was able to get myself into rehab as opposed to being forced into rehab that I was able to finally kick the chemicals for good.
This is Karina Borash with KVSC News. You're listening to a candid and open interview with Nate Cannon, author of Running on a Mind Rewired. Cannon is sharing his story of growing up in the 1980s and struggling with identifying as a girl by the name of Jennifer. As we continue, he talks about gender identity, drug addiction, and strained relationships, and how he overcame the rejections in his life to become the man he is today.
What is the first step in a recovery process?
I can only speak from my experience, but I think for me it was realizing that the problems that this chemical is creating, whatever that chemical is, whether it's cocaine or crack or meth or alcohol or whatever your drug of choice might be, just recognizing that the problems this is creating are far outweighing any benefits that it's giving me. And what little high I've gotten from that is no longer even fun. And I think when you start to have more consequences than ways that you can justify your use, you start to realize that this isn't fun anymore. This isn't something I want. I want to make a change.
And so you went into another treatment with a new mindset.
Mm-hmm.
And how was that different?
I think the mindset was different in that I knew I was doing this for me. And I was doing this because I wanted to get myself well, not to satisfy some state requirement, not to make Gustavus or the school happy, not to make my mom happy, just because I wanted to do this for myself, because I knew that what I was doing was impacting my life and impacting my future and endangering others as well for some of the things I was doing, like driving drunk and things. And it was also having a great impact on my relationships. And so I really wanted to make that change for me.
I'm curious as to how old you were when all this took place, because in your book you mentioned that you spent the first 30 years of your life battling these addictions.
12 when I was first diagnosed with depression and anxiety. So that was my first experience in treatment. And then my last chemical dependency treatment came in 2004. And I was 23 at the time when I got sober, which is a really, really difficult age to get sober, to be quite honest. A lot of my friends were very much in the, "We're going out every Friday, Saturday night, and we're just going to get hammered." And that's just kind of typical for the age, I think. So taking that step at that age was quite bold, I think, especially at that time in 2004. I was like, what's wrong with you? Just, you know, stay on the party scene, keep doing what you're doing. And I just wasn't willing to do that anymore.
And you've been sober for how long?
11 and a half years.
So what is your alternative now? What are your hobbies and interests?
Well, interestingly, when I got sober, I got on a treadmill one day, and I had really hated running growing up, to be honest. That was something that, as a hockey player, maybe that was a good way to kind of avoid having to do a whole lot of running. I always dreaded those dry land practices that we had to do because it involved running. But for some reason, I got on that treadmill, and I got a high. And it was a high that felt natural, and it felt real, and it felt really good. And though I couldn't run very far, I decided the next day I'm going to get back on that treadmill and see how far I can go. And so what was a half a mile became a three quarters of a mile. And over the course of a couple months, I got sober in February when it was kind of icy and cold out. And then spring started to blossom, and I got myself outside and I started running outside around the lakes in Minneapolis. And I realized that there is, nature is just an amazing thing. And these are the things that I'd been missing out on by being up late and just drinking myself into stupors or using drugs up all night. And I realized that that calm peacefulness of the early mornings was just very cathartic and almost spiritual in a way. So I really started to enjoy running at that point and got into running early in the morning. I flipped a lot of things in my life upside down. You know, my sleep cycle had been backwards. I wasn't eating right. I really had to relearn a lot of those things in order to get my life steady again. And for me, a big piece of that was the hobbies. I needed to find things to fill my idle time because, you know, as they say, idle hands can be the devil's playground. And indeed, I knew that was going to be true for me. So I really threw myself into getting my body and my mind well. And really embraced running as a sport that has given me kind of a natural high.
And you've completed marathons too, I understand.
Yes.
When did you complete your first marathon?
2009 was my first marathon. And that was something that I had recently been diagnosed with a neurological disorder that developed in 2006, 2 years after I got sober. And it took me 3 years to get the right diagnosis of dystonia, which is a first cousin of Parkinson's disease. And my movement disorder neurologist told me that I rewired my brain via chemical dependency and head injuries, which is kind of where the title of the book came from. That was a big, big thing for me. It really impacted my career. At the time, I was working as a paralegal, and I had to make a lot of changes in my life. And I decided at that point that I've got some people telling me I can't do this anymore, I can't do that anymore. And I was just getting used to getting my functioning back here as a sober adult. So I decided, you know what, I'm going to prove these guys wrong, and I'm going to run a marathon. And I got a lot of pushback on that. Nobody ever came right out and said, you can't do this, we won't let you do this, but there was a lot of concern. I'm not sure you can do this, and this might not be good for you.
And you wanted to prove them wrong.
I did. That seems to be a kind of my MO in life, I guess.
As long as you believe in yourself, you can do anything,
mm-hmm.
I believe. I think the ceiling is a lot higher than people realize with what they can accomplish in their life.
Absolutely. I've now run 7 marathons. I've run the Twin Cities Marathon the last 6 years and completed the Los Angeles Marathon in March. And I'm currently training for the Twin Cities again this fall.
Wow. And now I want to talk a little bit about the support you received from family and friends, and not only with running and running marathons, but also beforehand when you were going through treatment. How did your family react and your friends react to what you were going through?
During my high school years, when I was getting involved in cocaine and then switching that into crack, that was a difficult time. I think a lot of people kind of backed away from me. They knew that I was losing weight very rapidly. I was very gaunt, just looked very pale and unhealthy. And I had a very, very good friend at that point that was a great, great support for me for a while there as I went through my addiction. She was battling some stuff of her own. And so I think having folks in my life that had similar battles was very, very helpful. But I did lose some friends out of that. And when I got to Gustavus, there was some folks there that back in 1998, when I started at Gustavus, we didn't really talk about drug addiction or even alcoholism, really, to be honest. So finding folks that could kind of empathize with what I was going through was a challenge, but I found those folks, and I made some really, really wonderful friends there that supported me and wanted to make sure that I got the help that I needed and weren't just using buddies.
And how about your family?
My family's been kind of split on that, to be honest. I have 2 brothers and a sister, and my mom was very, very understanding of what I was going through, did not believe that tough love was going to be the right approach to my illness. My oldest brother very much had the opinion that, yes, tough love is what we need. We need to, at that time, we need to kick her out of the house. We need to develop a contract to make sure that she's abiding by the terms of her UAs and that kind of thing. And my mom kind of took an opposite approach that, no, if we end up kicking her out and putting her out on the street, then this is only going to lead to more drug use and more problems and more mental health issues. And so there was some disagreement, I would say, among my family members about how to manage my condition. My brother John, who I do talk about in the book, was a great support for me, though, and he was there at my first rehab, and I'll never forget him picking me up in his arms when I told him why I got kicked out, and I cried, and I told him, John, I didn't do this, and he believed me, and my mom believed me, and I think that those two were great supports for me.
What kind of support did you feel that you needed at that point?
Not giving up on me. I think that that's the biggest thing that I've seen happen sometimes with families, having worked in the mental health and chemical dependency field myself for a couple years there, seeing folks that have lost their support from their friends and their family and feeling like everyone's given up on me. And if everyone else has given up on me, why should I believe in myself anymore? And so I think having that support, that ongoing support from my mom, my brother, and my sisters was absolutely crucial for me to eventually get well.
Who specifically did you feel helped you the most, friends and family?
I'd say my mom. Being that she is a social worker, I had to kind of draw that line, and I still do to this day, that mom, you're not my therapist, you're my mom. I need a mom, not a therapist. Sometimes she wants to get into that mind frame, but overall she's just been an exceptional support for me throughout a number of issues that I've gone through in my life.
Getting back on track to the running, where did your life go from there? You started completing these marathons and your running was helping you mentally get back on track, but you're still battling dystonia and you're still battling your past.
Running is something that I think for me is very meditative, and being a longer distance runner, it gives me kind of time to kind of process through things that I might have not otherwise processed through. And so when the dystonia hit, I realized that this was impacting my running, and suddenly I was having to be much more conscious of how I was running, what my posture was doing. I was having a lot of problems with pain and discomfort. And so once I was able to start getting treatment for that at the university in the form of Botox injections, that really helped me kind of get back on track with the running and continue forth with that. And just kind of, like I said, process through other things in my life and use that as a meditative outlet. Through the process of doing that, along with the process of writing my book, I think that that was really when I started to realize some things about myself that I'd buried since I had been a kid, about my gender identity.
This has been the first of a three-part interview with Running on a Mind Rewired author Nate Cannon. In this segment, Cannon shared his past struggles with gender identity, drug addiction, and rehab treatment, wrapping up with a newfound love for running and writing, two hobbies that help Cannon overcome his history. Tune in tomorrow during KVSC's new Newswatch program for part two, when Cannon opens up about writing his book and transforming from a woman to a man. Running on a Mind Rewired is a memoir published in November 2011. Author Nate Cannon shares his history of struggles as an adolescent, feeling uneasy about his gender as a young female. In this three-part interview series, Cannon opens up about his past of drug addiction, alcoholism, and many rehab attempts. This begins part two, in which Cannon talks about discovering his true self after a near-death experience through running and writing, learning to live with a neurological disorder, and ultimately making the gender transition from a woman to a man.
Running and writing, I think, are probably the biggest two hobbies that I've developed in my sobriety. I've wanted to be a writer since I was a little kid, but really embracing that in terms of I'm really going to do this. I'm really going to sit down and I'm going to tell my story. And I'd felt called to tell my story since I was 17 and had my first suicide attempt at that age. But it was really eye-opening for me to get into writing the book, especially while I was doing these long-distance runs. I would kind of process through things that I was writing about and kind of mentally form chapters while I'd be out on a long run, and then I'd come home, and it's almost kind of like verbal vomiting, because you start to feel like this is stewing inside and I need to get it out, and so it's almost like your mouth starts to water. I gotta sit down at the computer and I gotta get this out now. And so in the process of doing that and having this kind of running and writing routine, I really started to learn a lot about myself that I hadn't realized. And a lot of things started to resurface, namely the gender dysphoria. And I thought I'd kind of put this away. That was one of my first memories, is telling my mom that I wanted to be a boy and it had been a mistake, and can't she just take me in and get me fixed? This seemed very logical to me at age 5. But again, Iowa, 80s, we didn't really talk about that kind of thing. So it was something that resurfaced again when I was 12 and I had my first round of depression. They did note that I had depression, anxiety, as well as gender identity disorder. But that wasn't something that was dealt with in the treatment. So none of the treatments I went through, either mental health or chemical dependency, or for both dual diagnosis, dealt with any sort of gender identity issues. And I had come out as a lesbian at 18 at Gustavus, started dating a girl there who I fell in love with, and after her, I had met a gal at the university who I developed a life with. We'd bought a house, and we were having a great time, both building our careers, and everything was just taking off when my neurological disorder set in, and that really hampered that, and then put me out of work in terms of my ability to continue work as a paralegal. So that weird set of circumstances that were all kind of negative, but they all kind of came together to give me the time that I needed to process through some stuff. And in doing that, that's when I started to realize that I'd been confusing my sexual orientation with my gender identity for much of my adult life. And that a lot of those transgender feelings I had when I was a kid were still there. I just managed to somehow push them somewhere into some subconscious area when I hit about 12 or 13.
Do you feel, when they diagnosed you with gender identity disorder and all of these other disorders, do you feel you can put a name on something that you're experiencing like that? Target it as a disorder. You have this condition.
I think with the transgender issue, that's a big source of debate as to whether that should be classified as a disorder. Recently, the change has been made for the current DSM, which is the Diagnostic Manual for Psychological Disorders, that the terminology is different now. They don't no longer use the term gender identity disorder. They use the term gender dysphoria. But it still does fall under a sexual identity disorder, and so it kind of defeats the purpose in my mind. So I would really like to see it removed. I know a lot of folks that are transgender that I've been affiliated with or acquainted with. Those who have had mental health struggles, a history of addiction, or have a physical illness, they seem to run into more roadblocks in terms of transition, in part because of all the hoops you need to jump through to meet the criteria to move forward with your transition. And part of that is that you need to have a mental health diagnosis. It just seems counterintuitive that you would have to get a mental health diagnosis in order to become your true self. I think that with other labels, and that's what they can kind of become, is labels. I have learned in the last few years here, I had, unfortunately, a break with reality, a psychotic episode in 2013 that definitively changed my diagnosis from major depression to bipolar mixed episodes, meaning that I do get both depression symptoms at the same time I get manic type symptoms, so racing thoughts and kind of collide with irritability, and I just feel kind of like my brain's in a wild fireworks show where I never know if it's going to be yellow anxiety or blue depression followed by red and anger, and it's all kind of jumbled up into this big messy ball of symptoms that were really hard to unravel for my team because of my history, because of the history of brain injury, because of the history of chemical dependency and that kind of thing, and no one was really willing to make that leap on the diagnosis until, unfortunately, my brain did kind of go a little bit far off the deep end, in the sense that it just kind of broke with reality, and I started to believe that some things were happening that weren't really happening. And having that change in diagnosis, I think, was something that was, again, kind of one of those enlightening moments where I went, wow, this fits, this seems right. And I can say that is true also for my realization of my gender identity, but there was so much more shame involved with having the gender dysphoria resurface.
What do you mean shame? Shame for yourself or shame from other people?
Primarily shame from internally, yes. It's one of those things that I guess I'll never quite forget. One of the moments I had when I stepped out of the shower and I saw myself in the mirror there, and I saw my female body, and I looked at it, and I really, really looked at it, as opposed to just, this is my body and these are my breasts and this is the body I have. I'd accepted that I was female, a woman. I'd accepted that I had these secondary sex characteristics, but I don't think I really accepted that's who I was. I thought back on times when I was playing college hockey and I felt like a guy in the women's locker room, like I shouldn't be in here. And I didn't quite know what that feeling was about. But I remember having this moment when I took a shower and I just really looked at my body and I put my hands up and I just covered my breasts and I started to think about having a flat chest. And suddenly I started to kind of see myself more in a masculine light and think about what it would be like to have a male body. And as soon as I was able to kind of get into that moment and embrace that, the shame just hit me. And it was just this internal, you're a freak, no one's ever going to love you, you got to stop this now because this is sick. And that was kind of how I treated myself for a while, was that you need to stop it. This needs to get put back into your subconscious, just put it away. Because you put it away when you were 12, 13, you can put it away again. Don't listen to what these messages are saying.
What kind of effect did that have on you, thinking of yourself that way? Hide it and don't be this way, be something else.
It was very, very detrimental. This really came to a head in 2010, early 2011, and by that point I was pretty far along with my book, so it was moving forward towards publication, and it was difficult. I didn't know who I could trust to tell, including my own partner. We had been together since 2001, so we'd been together 9 years at the time when I finally realized that I couldn't hide it anymore, and that my hiding it was impairing a lot of aspects of our relationship, not just the way that we interacted at dinner, but intimately, and the activities that we participated in, kind of how gender roles were assumed by each of us within the relationship. And so I really didn't know who to trust. I did eventually come out to her, and though it did seem like there was a lot of support there and she really encouraged me to embrace this, I wasn't quite ready to go at the transition the way that she wanted to kind of push me into it. I needed to slow it down and go a little slower. But at the same time, I also felt that there was a fundamental change that happened in our relationship when I came out. She had identified as a lesbian, and by my coming out, that changed her sexual orientation. And I knew that she didn't want to be with a man. So that was something that I knew we were going to struggle with.
Now, is this the partner that you've dedicated and talked a lot about in your book?
Yes.
And when did you meet?
We met in 2001, playing club hockey at the University of Minnesota.
This is Chrissy?
Yes.
Chrissy? Where is Chrissy today? And how did you move through everything after you coming out? How did your relationship change? And how about today?
Our relationship really changed a lot. I think, unfortunately, I look back and I sometimes feel like she might have felt like she needed to be more feminine in order to suit me, because I was starting to take on more masculine appearance and masculine role, if you will. And that didn't fit her. So I think she was trying to kind of change herself a little bit to suit me. And that's not going to be healthy for anyone. So, you know, we had some ups and downs with our relationship. And things really kind of came to a head after the book came out. And when the book came out with my female name on the cover, I just couldn't reconcile the messages I was receiving from the outside world that, you know, you go, girl, you're such an amazing woman. These very gender specific kind of compliments that were just amplifying this distress, this disconnect between who I was feeling I was on the inside and who I was projecting to the world on the outside via this book. It kind of made me feel like a fraud, to be honest. And after that book came out, I really spiraled into a very bad, bad round of depression mixed with this anger. And our relationship by that point, I felt was superficially good, if you will. I remember her telling me that, you know, we're going to get through this, and, you know, together we make one of the strongest teams around. And she tried to stick by my side, but mental health was something that was a struggle for her to understand. There wasn't mental health history in her family. And I think she kind of wondered why I couldn't snap out of this and just get myself together. So that really changed things in November of 2011. And soon after that, it wasn't about 3 weeks after I had the book come out that I ended up having a second suicide attempt. And it came after her and I got into an argument. I don't remember anything about what led up to this, but according to what she told my mom, I got very angry, and she got kind of scared of me. So at that point, she decided that she needed to leave the relationship, and I was in such a dark place that I just went forward with a suicide attempt. My mom actually talked with her after she left the house and implored her to go back to the house because motherly instinct told her something was wrong. And Chrissy said she wouldn't go back. Her own mom told her not to go back. And my mom said, you need to go back right now. I'm telling you, something's wrong with my kid. And Chrissy did, and unfortunately found me unresponsive, unconscious, and had to do CPR. I subsequently went into complete respiratory failure and ended up in a coma. When I came out of the coma, she told me, I can't do this anymore. I need to leave.
You're in a coma, and I don't know for how long?
It was about 4 or 5 days.
Okay. And you come out, and you realize that, once again, you beat death. You tricked death. Mm-hmm. And you find out that Chrissy, your partner, the love of your life, is now trying to move on.
Right.
What's going through your mind?
Where do I start from here? how do I rebuild? What do I do next? I really had very little going for me at that time, and there were a couple things working against me. One, the disability aspect of things that I hadn't been working, had been working as a writer to get my book out there, and so while that was bringing in a little bit of income for me, it certainly wasn't enough to keep a roof over my head. We owned a home together, but since gay marriage was not legal at the time that we were together, we were never able to get gay married, if you will. And since we couldn't get, quote, gay married, we couldn't get, quote, gay divorced, which put me in a very tough situation in the sense that she, being someone who had an MBA and a very well-paying corporate job, she was responsible for a lot of the finances, and happily so, and I trusted her with that. But unfortunately, that did mean that I really had no legal rights in terms of what I could do to get spousal maintenance or anything like that you might find in a legal marriage. So she left, and I really just had to just frantically get myself back into work, any kind of work that I could possibly do in order to just keep a roof over my head.
Now, that's a lot of negative. So what were the positive aspects that you hung on to that kept you waking up every day and that made you want to continue on?
The biggest thing that kept me going was that I refused to die as a woman, and I refused to die in that house that she and I owned together. That house, nothing good had happened since I bought that house. I literally developed dystonia about 2 months after I bought the house, and then the economy crashed, it sank underwater, lost a lot of value. It just kind of symbolized a lot of negativity that was going on. And likewise, even though I was still having very pressing suicidal thoughts after the suicide attempts, and in the months that followed, and thinking, how am I ever going to get my life back on track with everything I've just lost, I kept thinking to myself, I can't do this to myself. I can't take my own life as a woman. I need to transition and become who I am and give myself a chance and give Nate a chance.
This is Karina Borash with KVSC News. You're listening to an open and personal interview with Nate Cannon, author of Running on a Mind Rewired. Today, he is busy writing his second novel and has received much support for his talent. Cannon is sharing his battles with suicidal thoughts, a failing relationship, and his final moments as Jennifer, a young woman who aspires to become a man.
And what is the process that you changed from Jennifer to Nate?
I had started pursuing some aspects of that actually before the book came out in 2011, and we ran into some roadblocks, one being that we were initially approved for my chest surgery to go through, and then after we had set a consultation and done that, move forward, the insurance company came back and said that I hadn't met criteria because I hadn't been living full-time as a man for a year. That's a pretty common exclusion policy that insurance companies have had. Things are starting to change now. But that was difficult for me. I couldn't meet that criteria because I hadn't been working. And so I couldn't think of any other aspects of my life where I could demonstrate that I was living full-time as a man. And likewise, I think that's almost a recipe for a hate crime. I looked female, and it would have been tough for me, especially prior to starting hormones, to have passed as a man. And so I could see that if I had done that, that would have been very, very detrimental to my mental health as well. So there were some steps that we tried to take, but ran into roadblocks. And likewise, I did start some therapy, gender-specific therapy that I was required to go through, and ran into some roadblocks there where I had the gender psychologist kind of say, well, let's come back for another couple weeks. Let's keep going with the treatment here. And I'm thinking, no, I know what I want. I know I want to move forward with surgery, and this is what I'm asking for approval for. There's nothing more for me to talk about.
And you're sticking to your guns.
Yeah.
I like that.
So there was a lot of roadblocks prior to the suicide attempt, and my approach to it after the suicide attempt, I think, was very different in that I kind of knew better the community resources. I'd started to kind of plan my own map, if you will, towards transition. My background as a paralegal really came in handy because I was able to read some of the finer points of the law and plan a course for myself that would make sense. So the first thing I did was I made sure that I started the chest surgery process right away because I had the letters of approval for that from my psychologist. So I got that appointment scheduled the surgery in April of 2012, wasn't able to schedule it until October, I believe it was. And during that meantime, got in to see a hormone doctor, an OBGYN who works with transgender folks, and with her approval, got started on testosterone. And then 3 months later, went through the surgery, and by that point, had already arranged to have my name change and gender marker hearing. It was a name change hearing, but I had specifically requested to have the gender marker changed as well. Following the surgery, you receive an affidavit from the surgeon that tells you that your biological sex has changed, that he has performed irreversible gender reassignment surgery, and that the medical facts now should read that my gender is now male. So with that letter and with support from my OBGYN, I was able to take that documentation to the name change hearing in December of 2012 and get my name changed as well as my gender marker.
Do you feel there is a specific date or a specific moment where you became Nathan? And it might not even be going through the physical changes. It might have been a mental change, but when did you feel that this is who I am?
That's a tricky question, because I think there's a period of time where in 2012 where I tried to come out in my employment setting, for example, and was met with some resistance, and I simply asked to change my nameplate and my name tag. I knew I couldn't change any of my HR records, and you could just hear the crickets chirp. And so I took it upon myself to just tick some masking tape, and I changed my first name on my nameplate and on my name badge, and lo and behold, soon after that, and I changed my name in Outlook as well. And then soon enough, they came around and they gave me corrected ones, if you will. And I think when I started to take steps like that, that was when I started to realize that this is who I am. And if you can't accept that, then that's your problem and not mine. When I was able to make that distinction, I think that's when I really started to embrace who I was and say, this isn't about me. I'm comfortable with who I am. My mom struggled with this. She wanted me, and she felt like she was losing her daughter. She cried the morning that I went to Florida to have my surgery done, feeling like she was going to have to say goodbye forever to that person. And indeed, she was. But I tried to remind her that it's not so much that you're losing a daughter, you're gaining a son. And so let's look at it that way. And it took us about 2 years of some struggles before I finally saw her here about 6-8 months ago, and she said, you know what, you just make such a handsome guy. This is the way it should have been all along. And that was kind of when I had the moment when I realized that I've accepted myself and people are seeing that this is right for me, that this wasn't a mistake.
That just goes to show that it's really not about what's on the outside. It is what's on the inside. It is who you are as a person.
Absolutely.
I know you've struggled with self-esteem issues too, but how did that change once you became Nate?
Initially, early on, it was a struggle because I was feeling like a man, but yet my voice hadn't quite dropped from hormones prior to the chest surgery. Of course, I still had breasts, and though I could bind them, I knew that they were there and worried about that when I'd be out in public that people would see that, you know, oh, is that a man or a woman? And sometimes I did get that. And you get a lot of looks on the sidewalk and things, and you hear people kind of talking to the person next to them going, hmm. And you can just kind of know that that they're questioning your gender. I didn't want to start to read too much into that, but I did end up working in a mental health facility for adolescents who had dual diagnosis. It was a long-term care facility for kids who are classified by the state of Minnesota as severely emotionally disturbed, which is a very unfortunate wording, but that's how it is phrased. And in working in that environment, I went in as a male technician, and being a male tech in that environment, I was working with adolescent boys, but the kids could see that something was different about my gender, and they started to make comments. And I hadn't been there for about 2 days before one of the kids popped open the door and looked down the hallway and said, my roommate wants to know if you had a sex change. And I was just kind of shocked by that. And soon after that, I started to get a lot of I guess, for lack of a better term, it was just harassing language, just things that the kids would say to kind of poke your buttons. But they knew something was different about my gender, and so they would harp on that. And I think that that was kind of a learning lesson for me to be able to say, again, it's not about me. This is their struggle, and it's not even necessarily a prejudice or anything like that. It's just, this is new, and this is different, and this is something that they haven't been around before. And so I tried to embrace that as a lesson in diversity, and was able to educate the kids with the administration's approval about what being transgender means. And a lot of the kids were very, very grateful for that educational opportunity. And I think that really kind of changed their mind about how they would view transgender people. So having opportunities like that has really meant a lot to me, to be able to, A, help myself and kind of just coming to terms with who I am and working through those initial months when my gender was questionable, and to now being read as a male consistently, can look back on that time and say, you know what, that's when I think things really started to change for me.
How did you address then when people started questioning you? What would you say to them?
Well, some folks, it would kind of depend. If it was in person and someone who knew me previously, you have to be able to forgive people for not getting pronouns right or names right. People who had known me for a long time would continue to call me Jen or would continue to call me she or her. And at some point you kind of say, you know what, that's okay. You're trying. So some of the people that I knew for a really long time struggled with it. But, you know, I just gently remind them, he, Nate. And then I'm sorry, you know, it's a slip, but I'll get used to this. And so just as long as I felt like people were really trying and were willing to kind of work with me and embrace it, I felt pretty good about it. There was a couple comical things that happened after I changed my name, though. My voice hadn't dropped a whole lot by that point, and I needed to make a lot of changes on accounts and so forth, that everything's legal, so I, you know, I had to get my name changed and my energy bill and all these kinds of things. And I called a very large telecommunications company that shall remain nameless. I said, well, you know, I've changed my name, I'm transgender, I have my name changed documents, so can I get my billing profile and everything else changed? And they directed me to a supervisor, and the supervisor said, well, you're going to have to do this in person, and just so you know, both Jennifer and Nate will need to be there. I said, okay, I'll make sure that both Jennifer and Nate
are
there.
I'll let them know.
Yeah. So it was, at some point, you kind of just started to laugh it off and say, you know what, this is just society's not knowing how to work with this yet, and that's okay.
You know, you could have looked at it negatively, too, and got mad when people would refer to you as Jennifer or make a mistake like that. So it really seems like you had a mindset change.
Absolutely. I think once I started to see some of the physical changes, too, starting to hear my voice drop and developing an Adam's apple, seeing the changes in my facial structure, and especially having the chest surgery, I really started to realize that this feels right, that I feel much better about my body and that I carried myself differently. I just felt more confident in the way I interacted with people. It didn't feel foreign to me. It felt like I'd come home.
And you're happy now?
I'm happy now.
That is an incredible story to hear. It really is. But how did you end your book?
The book ends with my finishing my first marathon, and
and that was back in 2009?
Yep, 2009. Okay. Yeah, finishes with the marathon and a little afterword about embracing what abilities we have and who we are now, and making sure that I'm not getting stuck too much in the past and just continuing to using a running metaphor to just keep putting one foot in front of the other and keep moving forward with my life despite the challenges and obstacles that have been presented.
How has your outlook changed? Your last suicide attempt was in 2011. How has your outlook on life changed?
To be honest, my providers know I still struggle with suicidal thoughts, but I think that that's something that I'm more willing to talk about these days. For a long time, it seemed like that was just a faux pas. You just don't mention it. If you mention that you're having any sort of suicidal ideation, they're going to call the cops on you and lock you up. And I feared that so much that I wouldn't mention it. And then it builds and it festers, and that's what ended up leading to the suicide attempt I had. It was a double-edged sword. I didn't want to let people know that I was having the mental health struggles I was having, because in order to move forward with transition, I had to be stable. So I couldn't really be honest with some of the people about what I was feeling. And I think that inability to express how I was feeling really contributed to how severe my mental health got in the months, weeks that led up to the suicide attempt in 2011. So my mind frame now has really changed in that I'm much more willing to be open with my providers and tell them, you know, I'm having these thoughts. I'm not going to hurt myself today, but they're here. Or if I'm feeling like there's a potential that I'm feeling unsafe, I want to make sure that I'm talking with them about ways that I can stay out of the hospital, hopefully, and develop a plan to find resources that are going to help me get through crisis-type moments.
They're your support system.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever feel beforehand insecure about telling people what was going through your mind, or afraid of scrutiny or judgment?
Oh, absolutely. And like I said, definitely the transgender issue. That was something, there was just so much shame involved in that I couldn't even bring myself to tell people, even my psychologist for quite some time, even what I was feeling or what kinds of thoughts I'd been having. I think the stigma of mental illness is so, so harsh, and it's very difficult to deal with that stigma when you're kind of scapegoated by society a little bit. And, you know, there's certainly a lot of stories that we've heard, and a lot of times we're quick to point to mental illness as the reason that some person did an XYZ act and created, I don't know if that's the right word, but caused some
maybe
sort
something
of
happened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't want to put anyone on blast in terms of just media coverage of certain things, but we've seen media coverage that has pertained to mental illness that points the finger at the mental illness as to the what caused someone to participate in some act that was not particularly healthy. So the stigma of mental illness, I think, is something that we really need to work on. Statistics show 1 in 4 people do have a mental illness. So this could be your sister, your roommates, or your friend. And we need to be able to address it, I think, a little better and have more open conversations about it. What I've been able to do, and it's really helped me, is I've gotten involved with the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and I've given about 50 presentations for them now about just telling my life story and some of the challenges that I've had with my mental health and how I've kind of overcome that, and hoping that we can kind of wipe out this stigma of mental illness.
And I know you share your experience out in the world. Where do you go and speak to people, and what do you tell them?
Well, let's see. It's kind of been an interesting mix. I've done quite a few talks in colleges. My book was used as a collegiate textbook at Augsburg for a while there, so I kind of started my circuit there. And then I've also been down to Carleton and have spoken at the University of Minnesota Medical School as well, the occupational therapy school there. Quite a few of the schools at the university. And also a lot of high schools. High school groups are very receptive of my message, which I really appreciate. And I think that that's a really key age to reach kids, because they're still learning and their minds can still grow and they can still be open to new opinions. And certainly we can in college as well.
I have noticed that younger generations are very open-minded.
Yeah.
Now with all of these societal issues.
Seems that
so
way.
I would say high school and college especially too, those are two very important target audiences. And especially since you can relate going through it at that age.
Absolutely. I think that that's where I've done most of my talks, and also with healthcare professionals who are working with people with addiction, mental illness, or a combination of those, even with the LGBT issue on top of that. That can be quite a trifecta of issues to deal with at once. But reaching out to and talking with professionals about how they can work best with transgender clients, for example, that's been, I think, very helpful for a lot of people as well. Typically, my message is very... I'd say I try and leave it inspirational in the sense that there's some dark points, but we kind of go through some of the chronology of some of the negative things that have happened in my life, and then we turn that corner and we find that by sharing the story in a way that gives hope and optimism, I think that really leaves an audience knowing that there is hope out there for them as well. So I always try and kind of frame the story in the sense that, yes, I've had these struggles and I'm going to continue to have struggles, and I'm probably still going to continue to battle suicidal thoughts, and this neurological disorder just isn't going to go away by itself, and I'm going to have bipolar issues. But these are things that we can still work through and live with and find good quality of life despite of.
This concludes the second of a 3-part interview with Nate Cannon, who wrote Running on a Mind Rewired. So far, Cannon has shared his dark past of self-harming actions and suppressing emotions because of gender identity. Since Cannon has undergone a sex change from female to male, he has spoken at high schools, universities, and medical schools. But he knows society has a lot of growing to do in addressing transgender issues. Tune in tomorrow as the series wraps up with Cannon's views on present-day media buzz about the LGBT community and what his future holds. The final part will air on 88.1 FM at 12:30 during the noon News Watch program.